Wherever you are, it's somewhere walking straight for you.
All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
Hi, my name is Jamie Roberts.
And I'm Robert Lendrum.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the movies that had you running away, but coming back for more.
How you doing, Rob? How's the week going?
You know what? I'm good. I'm not great, but that's because I got my second vax. No, I got my second vax, so I'm feeling the side effects of that second vaccine. But also just super excited to have a second vaccine and, like, you know, maybe have some normal life return to us soon.
Absolutely. Everybody out there who's got their first vaccine, their second vaccine, and who feels crappy after their second shot. I have talked to many people. I would say most have felt really poor after the second shot. I'm actually getting mine tomorrow. So I'm really excited. My original second shot it was booked for September, and I was able to move it up to July 2nd. So I'm happy, but I'm nervous that I'm going to be feeling kind of junky. So
yeah, right before the long weekend too, buddy. And shout out to vaccine hunters, by the way. Anybody using their Twitter account just to find walk-ins and to find where pop-ups are happening. Like, I use them for both of mine. Walked in, walked out, got my vaccines pretty quickly. I wasn't in line for hours or anything like that. Those men and women over there are doing great work because they deserve some sort of an award, because so many people are actually using them just to find these vaccine sites.
Because the government did such a good job, right, Rob?
You know, I'm not going to give that. I don't even know, to tell the truth. I've never consulted the government site because it just wasn't up to date. Like, that's why using Twitter was such a smart idea. It's so much more instant. And you're telling people, like, go this morning. These guys are open until 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. like, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, yeah, I got my two shots through them. I'm in the Asmo Club. I got a shot of AZ and a shot of Moderna. So,
oh, you mixed it.
Yeah, because I got AZ first.
Little cocktail.
I don't know. They're saying it's better. I don't know. Who knows? So, Jamie, another thing that happened this week, Halloween. Halloween Kills dropped their official trailer.
Yeah, well, some guy released a version of it, and then it looks like Universal and Blumhouse had to get ahead of it, and they released the trailer. You took a look at it, Rob. What do you think?
I mean, it looks good. I love that. I'm assuming that opening scene of the house on fire is the opening scene of the movie.
Oh, for sure it is. For sure. Because that's how they left it. It's like really similar to, because it's a sequel to the first one, the first remake, right?
Right.
Just that continuous night, which is very similar to what they did in the original first and second, where it's like he falls, gets shot, falls off the porch or the balcony. And then the second movie starts with them looking over the balcony. He's not there, right? And then it goes to the hospital.
So it's picking up right where the last movie left off. So that opening scene is looks awesome. Like, just the idea that she's like, let it burn.
It looks so good. He's getting more terrifying through each movie. And I think hats off to the Blumhouse studio and the people over there. They are really, like, reinventing this character in an amazing way. In this, you know, the trailer, one of the critiques I would just say is that it gave up a lot. You know, you see a lot of parts of the movie, and you see a lot of like the standoffish points with him looking at either a group of firefighters that he's about to kill or a group of, like, vigilante community members that are coming after him. But it just looks terrifying. It's filmed so nice. It's crisp. It's scary, you know, like. And some of the kills are pretty brutal. So I'm pretty excited.
I was surprised how many kills I'm seeing in a trailer.
Like, fucking killed like 12 people.
The light bulb to the neck. Like, you actually see that. Like, usually in a trailer, they, like, hide, you know, some of those details so that you get a sense of what's about to happen. But, you know, go see the movie so you actually get to see the gore, right? I feel like they gave a lot of it away.
They're just not trying to, like, change anything too much, right? They're playing on the idea that this is the most evil person. They're playing on, what is it? Evil, family, and revenge. Like, who can't get behind those things? Like, it's just so good. Anyways, so I'm pretty excited. Well, great for everybody getting their vaccines. Things are getting back to normal. And let's get this podcast back to normal. And let's start it up. Rob, what movie are we looking at this week?
The movie we're looking at today, Jamie, is It Follows from 2014. This is a really interesting one. It was kind of a dark horse. Like, it popped out of nowhere. And it, like, what is it, won the Cannes Festival or something like that? Like, it came out of nowhere and won an award right away. And people were like, what is this? And like, got a ton of great critical reviews. It's directed by David Robert Mitchell. And, you know, I think he had only done one film before this. He's not, like, super well known.
Yeah, it was The Myth of the American Sleepover.
Yeah.
That took a look at a group of kids that, like, a coming of age story from suburban Detroit. A lot of people thought that this might've been a sequel to that original film. And he came out and said, you know, that wasn't really the case.
Thematically, like, though, you can, yeah.
Oh, thematically, for sure. There's a lot of similarities when you put the two of them together. You can see how those could be woven together. Absolutely. It Follows. Do you remember when we saw this movie? Because I think we saw this together.
Did we?
We did. We saw this at the movie theater.
Oh, I don't remember this. I thought we saw Witch. I remember we saw Witch at the movie theater. When did we see It Follows? We saw
Witch. I remember you calling me up going, Jamie, there's this new movie coming out. It's called It Follows. Yick was there as well. Shout out to Yick. Shout out to the Canadians about to win the Stanley Cup. Maybe. But yeah, we went to go see this in the theater. And, you know, I hadn't even heard of it. We weren't even sure what to expect. We go to the theater. And there was some rumblings about, you know, there being connections to, you know, perhaps a metaphor for sexually transmitted disease. But other than that, I hadn't really heard anything. So we go in there and I remember blown away might be, you know, a little over the top. But I remember coming out of the movie theater going, wow, what a great movie on a lot of different levels. Got me thinking about a lot of things. I thought my initial reaction was the music was interesting. A lot of the shots were interesting. It had, you know, it had that 80s feel to it for sure. And the music plays a big role in that. But I just thought it was interesting. It was fresh. It was new. It was like very similar to when I saw the Blair Witch Project for the first time and the movie finished and I was sitting in my seat. I was with a couple of buddies and just couldn't move because I was so blown away just how different and fresh and new and exciting, you know, the film was. I felt the same way with It Follows. What did you think about it, Rob, when you saw it?
I'm trying to remember my initial reaction, but I definitely love it. I think aesthetically it's very interesting. Like, it's just well done. The shots, those wide panel shots, like the super, like even the first shot of the movie is a super wide angle and it pans. And just like a super long takes, like it doesn't cut for like,
there's no cuts. Exactly. Yeah. They're just kind of one continuous take.
And that can be tricky because you have to really pay it off for the audience. You have to let them feel like something's happening. You got to like, you have to like intrigue them. And it's so interesting about that scene is the very first scene is the girl comes running out of the house, does like a circle, goes back to her house, then gets the car and drives away. And you're like, why the hell did she do that? And she's driving and she's got the heels on, so like right away you're super intrigued, like what is happening.
This movie tapped into one of the primal fears of like being a kid, and you know, we were always schooled on, you know, walk straight home and don't talk to strangers, and you know, you could be kidnapped and there could be somebody lurking around the street, around the schoolyard, walking behind you, kind of stalking you. I think it really taps into that fear we all have about walking alone somewhere, maybe late at night. Although in many of these scenes, they take areas of comfort, schools, hospitals, friends.
Yep.
And then they place that whole idea that there's someone following you. There's someone coming to get you.
I love that because it's like, wow, you made something so mundane become terrifying. And that's just like, if you walk down the street tonight or today and turn behind you and see someone else walking, just that creepy thought of like, what if that's not a person walking towards me? The other main theme that's really coming up to me, especially in a teenage film like this, is that whole sense of dread, that whole idea that they're always anticipating something horrible is going to happen. And your anxiety is all future tense. It's all about like, oh my God, it's going to happen. It's coming towards me. I'm going to have to encounter this soon. And I think the tie-in, especially because the monster is sort of transferred via like you said, like an STI, like a sexually transmitted infection or whatever, it does tie into this sort of idea of like again, like you said, we were told as kids, you know, all the dangers of sex. And this is like really, what's the word?
Hammering home that point, right?
Yeah. It's personifying that. It's what's the word I'm looking for? It's making that into a tangible thing. So Jamie, let's think about the very first scene. We talked about the girl running away, and then she drives away. She parks at the beach, lights on the car, points the lights at herself and at the beach. And then she talks to her dad, says, I love you, says goodbye, basically. And then there's a hard cut to her murdered, like, you know, splayed out on the beach, her high heels still on, which is this weird, like, connection to sex that I thought was weird. Like this idea of like, she's being sexualized in her murder. And she's been broken in a way, like her legs are broken in a like backward in a really gruesome way. So it really like, and that's before we know what the monster does. So then we learn the monster follows you. And I guess the point it gets close to you, it does this horrible thing and murders you. What I'm trying to figure out is like, it's so weird to me. Like I love how the movie doesn't show you this because the monster moves so slow and methodical. And it's often horrifying because it takes the shape of like someone who's naked and kind of bedraggled and, you know, looks like, you know, their makeup's all over their face or just looks rough or looks strange or, you know, but once it gets to you, it's going to harm you terribly, but it never shows you how it does that or what it does until later on in the movie, we get one scene. Cause there's only two deaths in this whole movie, Jamie.
There's only two deaths. And I want to just, before we jump to the scene that I know you're going to talk about, we'll talk about the first scene. Yeah. There's two deaths. There's the death of the girl that is being chased, attacked in the first scene. And then there's the death of another, you know, main-ish character later on in the movie. I feel like he wanted to make something interesting, fresh, unique, but still followed the horror constructs of old. That opening scene, that initial scene is meant to instill fear and terror, you know, I think through the viewer, but not give you too much. So often you're going to see a kill in a horror movie without seeing the actual killer. And we get the sense of sheer panic, terror. She's frightened. She probably, I don't want to, you know, we can speculate on things later on, but perhaps she had the curse for a long time and it eventually just wore her down, that idea of dread.
I definitely got the sense that she had given up.
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's what I'm driving towards here.
Okay.
She absolutely had given up. It was one of those, you know, really it ends up being like a suicide where she, and I think we can juxtapose that with some of the larger ideas in society that I think I can tie, or that I think that we can tie this movie into, not just with sex, but with some other stresses that people encounter. But she's absolutely given up. She's on the beach. She can see it. She can, but I think more so she can feel it coming. And it's more of kind of an internal battle, I think, that a lot of these characters have. Like you said, Jay doesn't sleep much, right? She's absolutely consumed with the situation that she's in, which is just so, so terrifying, so scary. And they tap into some of those basic things. Again, somebody just walking down the street. So we finish off with that first scene and then we kind of move into the movie where we start to establish the main character and then her connection with her kind of group, the ensemble cast, a group of, I don't know, would you call them misfits?
Not really. I don't know. I guess they're all it's weird. Her sister is definitely not a misfit. Her sister is probably like the hottest girl in school. Then their friend Yara, who's so weird to me, by the way, like,
yeah, what's the reason she's in this?
She? Why? That's exactly what I was thinking. It was like, at first I thought she was a sister and then I'm like, no, that doesn't make sense. And then they make it clear she's just a friend, but you know, it's weird because Yara is so self-absorbed in her, like, her Kindle reader in the clamshell that she's always reading.
Yeah.
Which is this other sign of virginal, isn't it like the clamshell is like a virginal thing because it's hiding the
like
pearl.
The pearl.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for sure. Yeah.
So I get this sense that sex has happened or Jay has had sex, but the other three characters, the sister, Yara and Paul, I get the feeling they're all virgins. But I don't know. We have nothing to confirm that.
But you know what? Actually, I want to add a little bit of wood onto the fire there, right? I think very, very, nondescriptly, the sister is talking with Jay about the guy she's dating, and she just says, like, really kind of flippant, "So have you done it yet?" Which I think leads to believe that, yeah, she's had sex before, and that's just, you know, the sister wants to know, like, have you gone all the way with this guy?
So yeah, I think it tells me that Jay's had sex before, but doesn't tell me that the sister has. It's so weird to me that Yara is there. She seems so self-absorbed that you never really get a sense of – absorbed in what she's reading, not self-absorbed, but absorbed in what she's reading. They never get a sense of why she's such a good friend to these people. Like, that friendship is never explained, but it's just there. It's just baked in.
Every horror film has this character. The only thing in this movie is that she doesn't get killed.
Well, yeah, and she speaks in metaphor, right? Because she only reads things from story.
I think that if one is faced with inevitable destruction, if a house is falling upon you, for instance, one must feel a great longing to sit down, close one's eyes, and wait.
She rarely has a line that's just her speaking. It's usually her reading something.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, she's an odd character choice, but she's there, I guess.
No, I like her because she does represent this sort of, like, context. She helps, like, shade the movie a little bit, but definitely, like, yeah, you get this ensemble cast, this teenage team. They're all coming of age and they're all interested in experimenting with their first foray into sex.
So what do you think of our first encounter with the monster? So we're talking about the scene where she's on the date with Hugh, and then actually he pulls the chute and they go out a second time and she ends up having sex with him. And then this is, I think, where the movie kicks into high gear a little bit, where, you know, they have sex and then all of a sudden they had sex in the backseat of his car, very teenage, you know, you go park down Lover's Lane. She's sitting there. She's got her hands underneath her chin. She seems really happy, or at least the facade of happiness. And then your first big, oh shit moment. He comes back in with, like, ethanol or whatever it is.
Chloroform, yeah.
Chloroform, exactly. Throws it on her mouth and then she's knocked out, right?
So what's really interesting about that scene is that Hugh chloroforms her, and he needs to pass on the curse through sex, but he doesn't rape her. He has a different set of ethics around this. It's not that he doesn't want to rape her, so he has consensual sex with her. Then he chloroforms her because he thinks, in a way, he's doing her a favor. But but what he's really being is a pragmatist here, because what he's doing is teaching her how to escape the monster, which prolongs him. It prolongs his life because it means that he's got someone in front of him who knows how to avoid the monsters.
This thing, it's going to follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you.
So he's teaching her this crash course that he puts her into here, where he chains her, ties her up to a wheelchair in her underwear, and then shows her the monster and teaches her everything he knows about it.
It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. Whatever helps it get close to you.
And then, like, drives her away. But, like, in this scene, it's so terrifying because she's completely helpless. She's tied to this chair. He finally shows her the monster down the hill, and he's like, there, it's coming, it's coming. And then it comes up the hill, and it just keeps walking right toward her. And it's a naked woman, and, you know, it's no one she recognizes, at least as far as I can tell. And it's just completely repulsively scary, because you're like, what is this person? Why are they acting like this? Why are they coming towards me? And that slow sense of dread is now established in a physical way. So then Hugh drops her off, and now he's got this sort of protective shield because he's taught her how to survive the monster. Makes me wonder, that first scene, I think her name is Annie that dies in the first scene. Was that Hugh's first girlfriend, or the girl before Jay?
The movie
implies it was, right?
Coming back to Hugh, I really vacillate between if this guy is a good guy or a bad guy. On one side,
he's not a good guy.
Well, he's not a good guy, but he's not a bad guy. You mentioned the moral ethic, the moral code. He's dating her. He's putting himself in more, you know, in harm's way for a longer period of time because he's not willing to take the step of going to rape someone and or going to force himself on somebody, right? But he also, like, this movie is set in this suburban 80s context, and he kind of typifies the...
Well, it's not 80s, though.
Well, no, it's modern day, but it's got the 80s kind of feel to it, right?
Okay.
But
I'll give you that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that he kind of typifies, like, your teenage boy, where you know, most of them are not terrible people, but they just make bad decision after bad decision. Rob, I know something about that, okay? Like, I'm sure there would have been other ways for him to expel or extol the reasons as to why the monster's coming after her rather than chloroforming her, tying her up into a chair and making her, you know, put her in that compromising position, right? But I think from his point of view, that was the only way for him to actually show her and for her to believe, was to really put her right in harm's way,
right,
and have that monster, you know, basically close to death. So he's a scared boy. He's a scared kid that is trying, I think, to do what he thinks is the right thing to do. But like I said, the decision-making of teenage boys is just, you know, not great. And you see that again here, right? Even when there's a really funny scene when later on in the movie, when they're going to find Hugh, because they want to know a little bit more of the backstory, and he's sitting there, you know, they're almost like in Goonie style out in the back of his suburban home. It backs onto a field, and he's just kind of like really twitchy. He's looking around. He's really nervous, and he says two things that are of interest to me. He says, "It's not done with me yet.
If it kills her, it gets me and goes straight down the line to whoever started."
And then he says, you know, just go and have sex with someone.
You do the same thing I did. I mean, it should be easy for her. She's a girl. Any guy would be with you. Just sleep with someone else and tell them to do the same thing. Maybe it'll never come back.
You know, you're a girl. It shouldn't be too hard. So he is almost like, you know,
move it along.
Yeah, move it along. Like pass it along. Like there's no sense in trying to confront the monster, the curse, the evil. It's just move it along, which tells me that there's more of like an existential angle to the whole idea. But anyways,
yeah, it's a hopeless situation for Hugh. He that's why he's driven to the point he's at. And I think you're right. It's interesting to see how much he's fallen apart in that scene, because he even says, "I shouldn't be sitting next to you," because the monster would kill her and then kill him if they were side by side.
And then there's a soccer player coming down, and then the music, it starts to, you know, there's a huge crescendo, and then it's just walks right by. So
just this weird looking girl.
Yeah, everybody's on edge, right?
Yeah. So then there is, and then like we said, there's only two deaths in this film. There is one more later where Jay finally decides, okay, I need to pass this on. I can't handle this. And she passes it on to Greg, who is like the teenage heartthrob who lives across the street. And he's like Mr. Cool, right? And he's like super like, you know, chill. And he's like, he doesn't really believe her either, by the way. He doesn't totally understand or believe the curse. I mean, at that point, he's actually seen examples of maybe it could be real, because he saw her hair get lifted on the beach. And, and you know, the door was kicked in, or the panels of the barn were kicked in, and where the monster came in. But we should point out, and we haven't said this yet, it's invisible, this monster, to everyone except those who have been cursed. So
yes,
Hugh can see it, and Jay can see it, but no one else can. And so when Greg finally, you know, is past the curse, he just like shrugs, and he doesn't really believe it's come his way. But Jay stays up all night, and she's just, you know, and she's paranoid. She's looking out her window, and she sees a strange looking person. Strange because they're dressed inappropriately. Like they're wearing like a full tracksuit, but no shoes or something. Like it's like a white, it looks like a pajama, or like a, it looks like a waffle shirt and pants, like as if you're about to, you know, put on your winter clothes over top.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like pajamas, right?
Yeah, he's wearing pajamas and no socks. He comes to the door, throws a brick through Greg's window, and he climbs in. So she immediately knows that's the monster. And that also demonstrates some of the thinking of the monster. The monster is able to figure out things. It's not stupid. It can't, like, if it comes to a door and the door is locked, it'll try to find another way in.
Well, they say that earlier on, eh? They say it's not stupid, but it's, I think Heath Hugh says that, right? Or Hugh, rather. It's not stupid, but it's very, very slow. Mm-hmm. So he kind of, you know, he warns her of that. But sorry, continue.
So Jay runs in to try to save Greg. And this is the moment where we see another death scene. And this is where it gets super weird to me. The monster takes the form of Greg's mom. And from my understanding, Jay sees it also as Greg's mom. So when Greg answers the door, he's like, "Mom, what do you want?"
What the fuck, Mom?
But Mom is standing there with one boob hanging out, and then she pounces on him in this way that you see from Jay's perspective. So you don't see, you know, what happens next. But the idea is, like, obviously she quickly kills him, because then we cut to Jay's perspective. She walks into the room to see what happened, and Mom is, like, grinding her son. And he's already, like, dead and blue.
Yeah, you know what? Just rewind it back a little bit. It's one of the first times in the movie that you see the supernatural element of the monster, because it doesn't just sort of jump into the room. It, like, flies into the room sort of with this burst of speed. So you see right. that there's just more than a human element here. And then you go in, and it was like, I've looked at this scene over and over again, and I've tried to, like, kind of just, you know, sort of understand it, and I find myself at a loss. But, like, he's in there, it's like she looks like Sigourney Weaver from, like, Ghostbusters 1, you know what I mean, when she's got her hair's all crazy and the lightning, and she's grinding him, and he's white as a ghost. I'm looking for meaning. I'm just not finding any other than the fact that it's just, you know, maybe the sexual tension between a mother and son, but I
guess I was going to go just like the monster kills via sex. Like, maybe it, you know, and this is where I go back to, like,
it didn't understand what it was doing. It got role reversal.
Maybe it, like, literally, like, it's a succubus. Maybe it literally fucks people to death. Like, but then what? We don't know what it did to Annie, but we know it broke her legs in this weirdly sexually, like, contorted way, like, as if, anyway.
Like, that's the actual kill?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, we don't see a kill ever.
That's true.
Like, on camera. But the only evidence we see is at the end of Greg's death, the body, like, she's mounting the body and, like, grinding it.
And you know what? Absolutely. And you know what too, eh? That could actually lend itself into the idea that there was only two deaths. Because if you're watching a movie where you're getting sex to death.
How many could they show?
It's like, exactly. How many could you show until even, like, you know, the most, you know, people that are down with that would be cool with it, right? I think it would run its course.
How would they rate that one?
Yeah, like, it would run its course pretty quickly, right? So I think you're probably right. I think that's a possibility in terms of how it kills, and you probably just needed to have the illusion of it, and then you actually see it. So then that's all you need to see. And it accomplishes its goal if that's the conclusion you're going to draw from it.
Mm-hmm. So let's start talking about the monster, because that, okay, I think, is the foundation of this whole thing.
So, you know, he dies, but, you know, isn't she still in harm after that?
Yeah. So immediately that means the monster's back onto her. So that's why she drives away again. And that's the thing about the monster. You can kind of just drive a big, long, like, 8-hour loop and kind of come home.
You'd be driving forever.
Yeah. But the point is, like, the monster is just going to keep walking slowly toward you. So you can, like, okay, I've driven for 3 hours. That means the monster's walked 25 kilometers. That means I can probably come back home now and sleep for 3 hours, because the monster can't cover that much time. You know what I mean? You can start doing the math. That's actually something I thought the movie was going to do a little more. Like, wouldn't you become a fucking mathematician or, like, a geography expert if you were being chased by this thing? Wouldn't you be, like, laying out maps and, like, timing the monster? Like, I'd be sitting there with a stopwatch being like, okay, the monster moves at an average pace of this. And then I'd be always trying to figure out my map.
It speaks to the point where you're alluding to the fact that you'd be able to manage your life with this kind of monster. With this kind of threat. And I think that talks about, you know, how would you escape the monster? How mm-hmm. would you manage your life with it? And then, you know, a third question, what do you think the origin of it is?
But, well, so let's talk about how Jay does it.
Oh. Yeah.
So Jay chooses to eventually Well, with consultation with Paul, like they discuss it and they decide to pass it on to Paul. And then there's an allusion that Paul has then slept with a prostitute that he's, I should say, a sex worker. He sees a street walking sex worker and they make it seem like, you know, he's considering that idea to like pass it on there.
Right near the end of the film, yeah.
Yeah, and at the end of the film, they're walking hand in hand. So they've, I guess their relationship has significantly changed in the sense that now they are boyfriend, girlfriend. And they're walking in the street together and there's in the distance, out of focus, something yeah. like person following them. Now, what I find interesting about that is, you know, four eyes are better than two. So maybe they've decided, hey, we can do this if we do it as a pair. We can keep our eyes open. One person can sleep, the other's awake. Like we can manage this better as a two-person unit than as a one-person unit. That was my thinking of how they decided to, you know, and then of course they did create the shield. But unless Paul did the thing that Hugh did and like explained everything to this sex worker, then I don't know how much advantage that is. He really got a I think Hugh was very pragmatic. Like you said, he's training, you know, his victims so that they will survive longer and longer and longer and will be able to survive so that he can survive.
It's interesting what you talked about. This is something that I want to draw into the next section or the next segment where we talk about some of the themes that we're pulling from it. The idea of partnership. The idea of coming together, the idea that four eyes are better than two, that maybe six is better than four, that let's bring in, and that would even, you could draw a connection right to the idea of the ensemble cast. They're supporting Jay throughout the traumatic situation. They're trying to help her. They're there with her right from the beginning of the film, essentially right to the end, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that speaks to a larger narrative within the movie that we can pull out here. But
speaking of the six eyes better than two, do you think the curse goes to three people in a threesome situation? Like what happens there? Or is it like, also, is this a heterosexual curse? Like,
okay. So you're pulling some things. So I actually had some critique on the movie and you're starting to wade into those waters.
Do you want to wait? Cause we want to talk about how to escape the monster. I don't want to get away from
okay,
that.
Okay. Yeah. Let's leave all that stuff just for a second segment here. Okay.
What was your plan? Did you come up with a plan?
To evade the monster?
Yeah. Did you come up with a plan?
No, but I thought that was the idea is to partner up and to almost like a commune situation and like be working. You'd have to be working together because the dread itself, the stress of it is going to get one person. Okay. It's nobody can stand up to something like this. Right. But I think with other people involved, I think that there's a chance.
The monster can take the shape of anyone you know, love, or it could be someone you don't even recognize. However, in the film, we see the monster take the shape of a few people that Jay knows. For one, it shows itself as Yara at one point when they're on the beach. And Yara's actually in the scene. She's in the water in the tube. And then the monster approaches her as Yara grabs her hair. But the other one, and probably the more important one, is the monster takes the shape of her dad. And he shows up, I believe it's the pool scene. He might be the man on the roof, too, of the house when they drive away, which was weird. Why was the monster on the roof? Why would it try to come in through the roof? Did that not throw off the concept a little bit to you there?
A little bit. I feel like it was just, you know, to quote George Bush, like for shock and awe. Like
it was just it was scary. Like to think like, that, oh shit, the yeah, monster was right there.
Yeah. Like they have to just kind of put those like, you know, exactly. Just those kind of visuals in to make sure that just kind of keep you on edge, give you a little bit of a scare, fright.
And we know that the father committed suicide. It's not really well established, but I think we do get that sense. I forget how he learned that. And the mother is turned into an alcoholic and she's not really a character. She's like a Charlie Brown character because you never see her face, but you hear her speak like an adult in the Charlie Brown cartoon.
Yeah, you just see her drinking wine, side profile at the table with the kids there,
yeah,
doing whatever. Do you think that there's meaning behind the father? I think so. Is if he's taking the appearance of, you know, the monster for the last scene, makes me think that that was a way for the monster to get close, for sure, because perhaps there's guilt from if it was a suicide from the family. Who knows what the family life was like? It, you know, I think in a lot of ways we see suburb as like this idyllic kind of utopia, but really, and you just, you know, look to the 1950s suburb stories, right? When you kind of pull back the curtain, you see that there's a lot of not, you know, a lot of window dressing in a lot of these communities and a lot of these families. So perhaps it wasn't the best upbringing, right? Perhaps she blames herself. Who knows, right? Like, she doesn't smile a whole lot in this film. So I think she retains some internal angst and guilt. And that
you
was
would, as you would if your father committed suicide. There is, it's interesting you said that to gain familiarity or whatever it was you said to get closer to her, because it could be about protection. Like, all this dread, all this fear is now built to this climax, and the monster presents itself as your father, who you haven't seen in a year. It might make you think, oh God, I want to say goodbye to my dad, and might get close. Which, by the way, Annie's on the phone with her dad in the first scene, right? Makes me wonder if the monster took the shape of her dad, because for Greg, it took the shape of his mom.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. She dies. We don't see what form the monster took, but there was a connection to her dad in that last scene, Greg's connection to his mom in his death scene. And then now at the climax, the monster hunting Jay takes on her dad's form. So that keeps coming back up. What do I make of it? I don't know. I think this definitely with Jay, it's more fraught because there's that tension that the father committed suicide, and that there's some sort of longing, or probably, you know, unable to like say goodbye, or all those kind of feelings of like, you know, when you lose a parent.
But she doesn't, you know, that would lend itself to like having one of those moments where she was like, Dad, you know what I mean? Where you see that in movies where it's almost like there's a vision, there's something that you know to be fictitious, right? And she doesn't. Like, it's just like, oh my God, look over there. Hit him with the toaster or whatever it is.
But you by know? Now she knows. And doesn't the sister say,
what do you see? I don't want to tell you.
And she doesn't want to answer. And I wonder if that's what it is. She doesn't want to tell the sister.
That it's their father.
Yeah. The other thought I had was, what if you slept in like a cage? Can the monster get through the cage? I mean, we know it's super strong, so I guess it could pull it open, because we saw it throw Paul.
I think that's debunked when we see the supernatural abilities of it, like when it flies through the, you know, son's bedroom door. And then also, like, you want to live in a cage for the rest of your life?
Oh, no, I'm just saying, could you sleep in one at night to protect yourself? And so here's the easy one. Why not fly to Australia and, like, relocate? Can the monster, like... travel internationally? Does it have a passport?
We go stay at Corey and Laura's.
Yeah. but why, you know, I mean, or travel, why not take longer trips away from this thing? I mean, one of my first thoughts is like, the only thing
because I think it speaks to the idea of, and think about this idea of the running away from your fears or confronting them. Mm-hmm. And not just in the context of the movie, but in the context of life. And do we really want to be doing that? Or do we want to be, and I like what they decide to do. They decide to stand up and fight and confront and, you know, get past it. But of course you could be traveling around the world. You could be going, you know, every which way to get away from it. But again, it follows, Rob.
Yeah, I imagine it would just start. It would appear one day, and it would be there. And I think maybe staying local is part of the way that you manage it, because you have to kind of keep an eye on it. You have to kind of know when it's coming.
Look at the incarnations of it. I think I counted 8 or 9 incarnations of the appearance that changes. Maybe it's a pilot and for Delta. And
yeah, what are you going to do? You can't get off the plane. You're screwed. You are screwed if you get on a plane.
Oh, exactly, right? Fuck, imagine it follows, you got COVID on the plane. Thing.
None of the deaths happen in public view. And yet the monster, if it caught you in public, we have to think that it would kill you, right? So would people just like suddenly like pause and look at you and you're just getting mauled apart? Like, how does that part work?
I think it's an intimate, it's a personal. And I don't, honestly, for me, I think the monster is just a metaphor for larger society, really, I think is what he's getting at in this movie. I don't.
Which is like
I think
the guilt that larger society puts on us for guilt for sex.
No, not even sex. I feel like this is just the grind of living. I think it's a far more macro existential look at society and what people go through and the idea of what happiness is, trying to even just get through, you know, bringing in some ideas of kind of mental health. I think maybe it's a reach, but I feel the idea that if you make poor choices or society has made poor choices for you, whatever, you know, whatever's laid out in front of you, it follows you until eventually it kills you. It's the marriage you're not happy with. It's the job you're not happy with. It's your whole life. And I think, you know, when I'm watching it, that's all that I feel. There's a sex element for sure. Sex is a sin and we should be pure and we bring it into water. But just the whole idea that life is really hard, which brings into the idea of how do we manage it? How do we escape it? Is partnering and seeking community and seeking, you know, I didn't want to drop that bomb on you right now, Rob, but I really do feel like this is just a commentary on life as we know it and just how difficult life is.
That's an interesting take. I really was looking at it, especially because of the teenage cast. I was looking at it through the lens of teenage shame and the idea that, like, as teenagers, we are often like, this is sort of like, you hear even from friends of ours, or, you know, I've heard stories of girls losing their virginity and they've kind of been horrible stories, like teenage boy just being a total idiot, whatever. And being a real asshole after the fact, after they've had consensual sex and then the guy turns into a total jerk. So this movie kind of epitomizes that. For me, it's like turning that story and blowing it up into an actual horror story. And the idea that shame follows you and that it marks your decisions it marks your body and that it actually follows you and influences your decisions as you go forward in life.
So is passing it on and having sex with someone else almost like some weird way of quote unquote infecting someone else and bringing them into your
shit,
almost like in the pantheon, yeah, your shame circle, like the pantheon.
I'm not sure because
but that's interesting as
well.
I don't
know if it's sharing it so much as it's like, what's the idea when you commit the crime that you're most adamant that you won't do, kind of thing. Like you say you're not going to do this one thing, and it turns to be
you're like a hypocrite,
yeah, it drives you to be a hypocrite. Like it drives you to do the one thing you swore yourself you were never going to do. I think that brings up another point. I know you want to talk about what would the origin of this monster be, because if they, you know, we were talking about this, like, would there be a sequel to this film? And apparently they tried to come up with one, but it didn't make it off the table and they decided not to do it. And one of the rumors was it was going to be about the origin. But I think the other way you could do another It Follows would be a totally different character has the curse. Someone who is not, like, someone more like Hugh. Someone who is not in a community of friends. Someone who is relentless and in conniving and horrible and I almost wondered if this movie was going to do that, where that we were going to see Jay's personal relationships and her friendships all get deteriorated by this curse, because she would start abusing them to save herself. But that didn't happen. Jay and her friends stay tight. So
yeah,
what if you do
the opposite?
What if you do this story with someone who's not as good as Jay, someone who's more of a villain and literally like gets their sister killed, gets their friends killed, like who keep.
But then do you care as much about them
to die by
that's
the end?
Thing.
That could be the ending, and then you can do another one again. Like, that's what I'm saying, though. Give this curse to a totally different person, you get a totally different outcome.
I think that's why this movie works and why this movie was so well received, is that like you care for the person that's been cursed, and they still come together, and she's trying to do. You know, good things with it. But throwing that at me right there, that's interesting. If it were just an awful character, you would be rooting for the villain. Yeah. You'd be rooting for the monster. It would almost turn into like, yeah, you'd flip it up. That would be interesting. I, you know, for me, the way the story is written and just like, and one thing I commented with you before is the pacing. I was like, I don't know if I like the pacing, but then, cause there was all these like changes between settings and, you know, individual, but when I went back and watched it, you know, for like a third and fourth time, I was like, oh, the pacing kind of works. It really is an hour and 40 minute film is its own nice little package that I think any viewer can really pull a lot of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it needs a sequel. Mm-hmm. I don't think a sequel is warranted. I think it was so successful that the studio would want a sequel, but this is where we need to stand up and say no.
Yeah, I think that was.
It'll be another project on a different thing. We gotta just stick.
Yeah, I don't think they came up with a good enough story. Now, like I said, that's one way you could do it is have like a horrible person. The other angle I heard they were trying to pursue would be figure out what the origin of this monster is. But the more I thought about that, I just couldn't come up with a satisfying. I think it would be such a totally different movie and be some weirdo. I don't know. It'd be like an Annabelle or something. Like, I don't know what.
In a movie like this, you don't want finite. You don't want finite answers.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want clear stops and starts and finishes and ends.
Well, I think what you're trying to say is also like the more you know and the more you concretize those rules, and the more we know about the monster, it's almost less scary because now you can start imagining ways to beat it. You can start like. You can theorize what it's about, what it's for, like why does it exist, and the fact that we know no reason, like we'd have no reason to understand, like why is it obsessed with killing people just because this curse gets passed via sex? Why is it want to kill people because of that? It doesn't matter.
No, this is why it's up to your imagination. I've come to the pod today with some theories. You've got different theories. They're interesting ways to look at it. And I think you need to keep it like that, as open-ended as possible. So if you think about what the origin could be, if you're going to hypothesize what could be the meaning, maybe not where the origin is of the monster, but the meaning of the monster itself, what do you have any ideas? Because I've been racking my brain trying to think about, so how would something like this start? And then I find myself sort of, you know, moving between a literal idea of it, a figurative idea. What do you think?
Well, yeah, figuratively, I was thinking of like how it represents shame and dread. But then, if we're trying to get concrete here and try to actually figure out an actual what is this monster?
Like, what is it? How did it start?
Yeah.
Like, is it a voodoo curse? Is it something that they have pulled in from another city, country? I really have no idea. Is it a disease? Is it what?
I was tempted to think it was some sort of curse begun like as a woman who was totally abused, but then I'm not sure how that holds water because it doesn't care about the sex being abusive or consensual or not. It's any form of sex that it goes after. So maybe going back to your religious thing, maybe it's like some hardcore Christian Catholic demon. It's like
that almost speaks to my voodoo theory. It's like,
but no, I tie it to Christianity more because of the sort of stance. Oh,
okay, sorry, Christianity, and then the stance of sex is a sin, and then somehow a reverse exorcism.
Sexorcism.
You know, I'd love to interview the director and ask him, you know, you came up with it, but did you came up with the idea, but did you come up with, or did you have an idea of the origin?
The backstory. Exactly
what we're talking about. I don't know the backstory. I don't think he has.
Yeah, because I think he was probably smart enough to say it's better without knowing, right? Because honestly, there is a logical conclusion where it fails. Like what happens if somehow the target or the last remaining target dies of old age?
Dies of
different reason. Does it just move on? And then what happens if there's nobody alive for the curse to go after? Does it like...
So like the end of humanity?
No. Like literally like, okay, say it's Jay. She gets Jay. She gets Hugh. Then she gets the one night stand that Hugh got it from. But then she got it from a guy who's like in his 50s. And then he got it from, you know, like, so, I don't know. I'm just saying like, okay, what if it goes back to the point where there's just no one left to go after? Like they're already dead or they are senior and they pass away of natural causes, or they die of a totally different cause, like a car crash or something. What if the monster doesn't have a target? Because there could only be so many. It's a finite amount of people that are on the list.
Yeah. I think we just have to leave it as is, and just, you know, we can pontificate all we want. I like your Christianity idea. I think the religion makes sense, but yeah, like what do you do if you die of old age? Who knows?
Anyway, but I think sounds like we're coming to the conclusion that yes, the movie works better without knowing those things. And it's more interesting. It's more, psychological. It makes you more scared because you're trying to figure out answers and you can't find them. And I think that's part of the dread, is like, there are no answers. Like, I don't know why it's coming after me.
Most good horror movies activate imagination. And this does that a lot in spades. And I think that's something important. That's something I want to mention in my review.
Okay, so here's a couple of things, Jamie. Jay eventually learns that the monster doesn't seem to like to walk through water. We don't really understand why, but I'm assuming that the monster, being as it's a supernaturally powerful thing, like that's not going to be enough to
Okay, stop. I've got a theory.
Okay.
I've got a theory on this, okay? So we talk about how to escape the monster. You talked about perhaps water. One discrepancy that I picked out in the film is near the end, they throw a blanket over the monster. Mm-hmm. And then people can start to see the shape of it, right? So mm-hmm. clearly there's like a physical shape there. However, when the monster goes into the water, and it actually does end up in the water here, you don't see that physical space in the water.
The displacement of the water should have been visible.
The displacement of the water should have been visible. That's shit.
Yeah.
That's a big discrepancy in the film. Okay. So that's one thing that I'm going to have to talk to Mr. Mitchell about. The second thing, and cue the Children of the Corn reference, I feel like the more that I talk and watch about horror, that horror and religion are just synonymous with each other in terms of going together like a scone and a cup of tea.
Like lamb and tuna fish.
Lamb and tuna fish?
Maybe you like spaghetti and meatball? Be more comfortable with that analogy?
Because sex is a sin, and it's, even though there's other ways to portray this movie and sort of understand it, that I think is one clear way to look at it. And then also, you know, water, as we've talked about in some of the other podcasts, and by the way, I'm not a religious person, for those out there that think that I bring up religion every time that I'm some religious person. I'm not religious at all. I just see the connections here. Water is connected for cleansing, for religious purposes. And you're right. There's a scene there where she goes to swim out to the boat in the water, where she's at the beach alone, right? And she feels safe going out and putting that water in between. And even though that he falls into the water later on, it seems to me that the monster is purposely avoiding the water. So perhaps there is a religious angle to be had with that. So I think if we were going to plan an escape, I think a boat would be the best way. Like a houseboat. Because But the first scene, she's at the beach near the water. Was she thinking about it? Was she close to that conclusion?
I don't know.
Jay later on swims out to that, remember, that group of people that is on the boat, and she swims out and then it just cuts, meaning that she was safe for that time.
Which, that's an interesting cut. That's a super interesting cut to me.
Very interesting cut.
Why didn't they put her on the boat and have her look back and see the monster walk to the shore but not come in? And then you get the light bulb in her head.
Because I think it gives us too much.
Right. But it was near the climax, though. I thought they would have like cued us in like, oh, she's learning to solve it. But they don't. They don't let us know what she's learned, which is an interesting move. Also, you're right. The water thing keeps coming up. When she gets to the cottage, she opens the window. Water is the first thing we see. So plus, she's constantly in the pool in her house, right? So Jay is often associated with water, and she's often in it, and she feels safe in it. We know that because in the opening scene, she's on her back. Yeah, she's just waiting in the pool. So why doesn't the monster like water? I don't know. But then when she does get in the pool, it does grab her. It still tries to get her in the water. It doesn't give up because it's in the water. And the water doesn't seem to be doing anything to
it. Which is the one kind of, you know, that pokes a hole in the theory there. But they're there in the swimming pool because they want to electrocute it.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. That's a fucking stupid idea anyways. But, you know, it sort of throws the theory on its axis a little bit. But I like the idea that we're exploring the water theme because it comes up a lot. Like you said, there's at least four or five or six shots or ideas where water is really prominent as something in the movie I think needs to be discussed.
But, yeah, yeah.
And that's actually a really cool, not cool, but I like the way they ended it with the whole pool turning red.
Yeah.
Very slowly, like it's really visual, right? It really kind of, it's gripping, really grabs you.
And just like the movie, it's very open-ended. What does it mean? And I love that.
You know, we've talked about the themes of, you know, societal pressure. We've talked about the themes of dread. We've talked about the ensemble cast that even though it's set in the modern day, there's a big 80s influence. It definitely has that like ensemble cast, that Goonies feel from, it's not the Goonies, but it definitely has that feel. Here's one of the things that I thought was pretty interesting in this film. When we did our episode on A Quiet Place, one of the critiques was that it was a very white film profiling a rural family that was all white. And my question to you, Rob, is can't we not apply the same critique to this film? And I'm going to go a little step further. So I find this is a very white film. The cast is white, the iterations of the appearances of where the curse is all white. And to add another layer to it, there's really the juxtaposition between the suburban and the city environment, which, side note, I find it very ironic that they're trying to outrun the monster and seek haven from it going into Detroit, which is downtown Detroit, you know, notably, although a lot better now, a dangerous place. So there's a little bit of irony in that. But, you know, with a huge African-American population in Detroit, I found that it was completely white.
Yeah, I think there's two black people in the whole movie, frankly, and they're not characters. They're just one line or someone in the background.
So am I reaching here, or can we not, why can't we apply the same critique to a film like this when, you know, when we're profiling supposedly suburban middle-class kids that are all white, we're in Detroit, it's all white. It's all white. It's all white. What do you think about that?
No, that's a very good point. Yes, you could easily insert characters like people of color into this film as main characters, because I don't know why there wouldn't be, frankly. Even in the suburbs of Detroit, I'm sure it's not like exclusively white. So that's a good point. Like maybe it's because he's trying to make it feel like those 80s horror movies, which were, you know, like that. But then you're just reproducing the same problem in a sense, right? You're just reproducing the representation problem that the 80s movies have.
Yeah,
and actually, it makes me think there was one black kid in all those movies, right? They didn't even do that.
Yeah, like, and we, you know, exactly, you know, and a lot of critique for like the tokenistic aspect of that. But I just feel like, and I've been to Detroit, you know, I'm Canadian, Rob, you're Canadian. I think our listeners know that now, but I've been to Detroit a bunch of times, really close to Canada. And if you really wanted, and he, you know, his first movie was representative of, was set in the same place. If you really want to represent where you're from, shouldn't you represent the people that are within the city?
For me,
maybe some people be like, you know, it's just a movie, but I feel these are certain things that need to be questions with the decisions that are being made, especially in this film, as we move through the different settings. We've got a suburban setting. We've got a city setting. You just go through Detroit. It just looks totally fucking dilapidated. And, you know, they go to the safe house. Then they were like out on Michigan and, you know, you get the boat, you get the kids on the boat. So I just feel like there was an opportunity there that maybe was missed, but that's just my own feeling with it.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I wonder about how that setting is supposed to even play into this story, in the sense that they are crossing through these different areas, and the sort of the rows and easy lines that you find in the suburbs make those shots really interesting to find the monster just walking down these straight streets. Whereas in the city, you know, they don't go into the city. They don't get chased in the city. We never get a chase scene. Well, chase, I should say. They don't get followed in the city. So we never really get a scene where they're, you know, racing through a more dense area.
They drive through, and you've got this. You've got the shot of them in the backseat of the car, looking out, almost like you would never.
You wouldn't get out of the car here.
When I was a little girl, my parents wouldn't allow me to go south of 8 Mile, and I didn't even know what that meant until I got a little older, and I started realizing that that's where the city started and the suburbs ended.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of black people just on the side of the street by like an old burnt out building. So it wasn't the best maybe representation of that community, but, you know, just one of the things that, you know, in my own work as a teacher, some of the things that we're talking about and I thought was interesting and worth mentioning.
Every week we like to bring you a story of true horror. And in these segments, we like to look at something that echoes what we're reviewing in the film. The film It Follows brings the impending feeling of death to a crescendo and haunts us with it throughout the whole film. That actually happened in this story.
The dread was so intense, the fear so palpable, that for 9 months, 8,000 men feared for their lives. For this week's installment of True Horror, we take you back in time to 1898 and the Tsavo region of Kenya. At this point in time, the British East Africa Company, a commercial association meant to promote trade in colonial lands, was building a railroad. A river lay in front, and a bridge needed to be erected. But work was slow, and time and money was precious. The British had invested much money in the project and weren't seeing the returns on their investment. So they sent in Colonel Patterson to expedite the process. Only time would show the horror and terror that awaited. Once at the Tsavo region, construction began. 8,000 Indian laborers, referred to as coolies, were busy working day and night, clearing the land, moving the sticks away from the dry Taro Desert, the desolate landscape with dead trees that looked like jagged spears. And no animals to be seen in sight. But they were there. During a 9 month span on the construction of the bridge, at least 35 people died, with some estimating that the death count was as high as 135. Every day, the men would work, and every night, they would go to sleep in an encampment that stretched some 8 miles down the railroad track. But one night, they awoke to screams of terror. Patterson and the others were alerted and quickly moved to the one tent where the labor had been working. What they saw was disturbing. Blood, a lot of it, and paw prints at the entrance to the tent. Understanding that something was wrong, Patterson set himself to hunt for the beasts. He walked around the perimeter. He went as so far as to tie up two live goats, perch himself in a tree, and wait for the killers, but to no avail. Night after night, more laborers were pulled from their tents, and at one point, 7 more victims came in 8 days. The feeling that the laborers had and the dread was something they couldn't escape. They were out in the desert. They were poor laborers. Their colonial masters had asked them to work. And there was nothing they could do except pray. As things got worse, they fortified their encampment with bull moss, thorny bushes surrounding the tents. The men huddled together at night. But still, there was more attacks. It was evident now that two lions, named the Ghost and the Darkness, were hunting the men. It seems that they had developed a thirst for human blood, although there's some talk and research on the construction of the jaw that would lead them to believe that they weren't able to kill their normal prey, yet had to go for something different, something easier, human. And these lions would still attack and still hunt, and sometimes jump into a tent and not take anything, and sometimes jump in and leave their victim alive. But other times, many times, they would jump over the bulmas, run into a tent, snatch the victim, pull them through the thorn wall, screaming, kill them, drag them to the riverbank, to the rocky walls where they couldn't be tracked and they couldn't be traced. Patterson would eventually kill the two lions, and they end up in a museum today that anybody can view. But for 9 months, they followed. They hunted. They killed.
Jamie, before we get to the rating of this film, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, School Coach. School Coach is an online tutoring company that helps you learn in today's modern learning environment, which, Jamie, you and I both know in this pandemic has been at home. And I think a lot of people out there are probably looking for a little extra help considering, you know, virtual learning. Depends where you stand. I don't know. I got little kids who do not like it. But there's people out there who need a little extra help, and this is a great way to do it because, you know, these are guys who are actually spending their time learning how to teach the best they can in a digital environment.
Yeah, at School Coach, they have teachers and instructors that are online experts. They do it every day, day in, day out. They offer a wide variety of services from online private tutoring to group tutoring to educational consulting. So if parents have questions about, testing, or if there's questions about, different things that will apply to what the student might be going through in school, then they're more than equipped to answer all those things. And they've got a lot of good reviews. They are the elementary educational experts. So they are focused on grades 4 to grade 9. So they mostly spend their time with their online tutoring for 9-year-olds all the way up to your first or second year of high school.
So don't let online schooling become a horror show for you. Contact School Coach at their website, schoolcoach.school, and you can receive a 25% discount on your first 4 sessions if you pop in the promo code RUNNINGSCARED. Thanks to School Coach for sponsoring this week.
Thanks, School Coach. Rob, we are at the time where we need to give this a rating. So how many footsteps are you going to give the 2014 movie It Follows?
I'm giving it four footsteps.
Okay, 4. Why?
I'm taking we always do this. We start and we go negative. I want first. I'm going to go the other way and make sure I start with why I love this film. It's so interesting. It's so haunting. It's beautiful to look at. The soundtrack is dope. The acting's great. I think all the teenage actors are, well, young 20s actors, whatever they are, is really well done. I guess what I'm taking off is what I'm coming to is just like, I love the monster. I love the idea that it's following. It's just slowly coming at you at all times. I guess what I'm taking off is I don't know if the storyline, which is about a group of friends coming together to defend their friend, if there's enough done, enough work done in the script, in the story, to really give us a reason why they all care about each other. I think Paul is the best example. He's done well because he has this deep crush on her that he, and he longs for her and he wants to protect her and he wants to be her boyfriend. But Yara, I don't understand her purpose in the film really, other than that she gets to sort of deliver these really interesting, you know, quotes from major novels and whatnot that she's reading that sort of give color to the film. The sister is, I guess we're sort of supposed to believe that that's all you need to know, just that they're good, they're sisters and they're good friends because they're sisters. And that's all you need to know. And therefore they're looking out for each other. And Greg is just there to, like, you know, help, but he's really like, I don't even know what he's doing there. Like he's trying to get laid, or is he like eyeballs Yara at one point. Like he just seems kind of creepish to a certain degree. And so what I'm saying is, like I was saying, if they did a sequel where it was a character who was an awful person who was actually willing to like burn every bridge and destroy every relationship they have to stay away from the curse, that might have been more interesting. Because in this dynamic, everyone's just happy to help. And I'm not exactly sure why. So that's the one little hole I'm punching. It doesn't at all affect my enjoyment of the film. I like the story. I like how contained it is. And I think it's delivered in a really beautiful package.
I think we're going to have to deviate at some point from giving the same review, but I'm going to give Four Footsteps as well. And I'll tell you why. Okay. So the movie is an enjoyable film. It's a horror movie, and it's got the horror construct perfectly, from the first scene of the death to this kind of battle between the monster. It feels almost like it's like a pseudo slasher with, although slasher films normally have high kill counts, but the idea of just something completely following you and you're in this, this ever present, ever state of fear, I think is great. The music is really good. The lighting is cool. The acting, the performances, I think Jay actually does a pretty good job. Greg, a little thin on his acting, but but I think for the most part, he's pretty good. If I'm looking for sort of main theme and main message of a horror film, I'm not sure if that's the intended thing, but I think he provided us with this work to make us think about it, right? And if I can pull out ideas from a horror film when I'm equally as scared, and then questioning myself, is the message he's trying to send out the idea of, you know, just how society kind of whittles us down, and you're sort of ever present, just kind of feeling dread of either sinning from sex or from society is a sort of a greater idea. Then if I'm thinking that hard about these movies, then I think that there's something absolutely there. For me though, and we talked about this with the idea of the sequel, it's like, this movie is like, for me, the first At the Drive-In album, where it just hits you because it's so new and it's so interesting, and it's the sounds are new in your ear and it's making me think about things in a different way. But I had to always ask myself why I didn't listen to any more At the Drive-In albums, why I veered and started listening to Sparta albums, is because Sparta albums, it's almost like the songwriting just became a little bit more refined, and they would release album after album, and I could sort of understand it as like a greater collection of works. And we think about It Follows, where it, like you said, the idea of people coming together, there's this existential threat that's coming at you. It's nice, it's new, it's fresh. How much more we can do with it, I'm not sure. And that's probably why we haven't seen a sequel, and why the movie will just kind of stand alone. And that's why it gets 4 out of 5 footsteps, because as a standalone film, it's fantastic. So that is
You're knocking Alpha Point because it can't have a sequel? Because you want more from it? Or do you think as it stands alone, it's lacking something?
I think it's lacking something where, you know, it's making me think about a lot of different things. Maybe it's lacking. Let me think about this for a sec.
The one thing I was going to mention here is, like you said, it's a very scary movie, which I think it really is.
Yeah, and it's a scary film.
It seems like we're seeing in the last 10 years the development of this sort of like concept horror. And A Quiet Place kind of falls into that as well, as It Follows, it, where it's like the monster is more of a concept than a literal.
Yeah, literal being, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know what? I think to get back, you know, I'm taking a point off because I'm hesitant to use the idea of like a one trick pony. You know, it's left so open that it's got nowhere else to go. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
I was comparing my head about why do I like this? Like, which one do I like better? This one or Quiet Place? And I guess because there's just so many more moments of visceral scare or visceral horror in A Quiet Place, where danger is much more present. Whereas in It Follows, I'm finding I'm much more affected by the dread, which is awesome as a technique in a film, but it does leave you like kind of like, okay, but when am
I? There's not a lot of macro perspective here, right?
Well, whereas, I was going to say there's not like scares where I'm actually scared for her life in that moment. Usually she's like 10 steps ahead and it's like, okay, she just has to run away again. Because the monster, that's all it does. It just follows.
So maybe that gets a little repetitive. And maybe it kind of, like I said, that idea of one trick pony, it was like Debussy was, you know, with the whole tone scale, you know, he was always saying like, it's just it's a one trick pony. You can't use it over and over again. So maybe just the idea of that concept, he runs it to an hour and 40, perhaps it gets a little bit repetitive. Maybe that's why he switches the setting so much. And you're constantly moving. He has to kind of continually have that on a carousel to kind of keep the interest level up. What do you think?
I think he accomplishes that. It does keep me interested, but I think you're right. Like there's just doesn't feel like a lot of other places to go. Yeah. And that's fine. I think as a self-contained single movie, it's awesome. Like it really nails it. And the thing is, like you said, we have all these things that we're talking about because it really opened our thoughts about all these other ideas that this film is generating for us. But at a certain point, you start turning around and poking holes back in it. And that's fine. Every movie is going to have that. But I guess you're right. You're left with so much openness that you're just like, there's nowhere to go. And like, that's not necessarily a bad thing because I think the movie didn't want to be more than what it was.
Rob, can I give a quarter of a star?
A step, son. We're not doing stars yet.
Can I give a quarter of a step?
So okay. What is it? A step and a toe?
This one new. Yeah, I think I'm going to have to do that. I've talked myself into not a step and a half or four and a half steps, but four steps and a toe.
Well, four steps is all you need to get ahead of the It Follows monster. So I guess that's a pretty good, rating. Like we said, we enjoyed it a lot. So let's move on. Let's wrap things up, Jamie. We are going to put out a poll on our Twitter. So we're going to do, we've been doing old movie, new movie. Well, pretty new movie, last 10 years. Yeah. So we're about to do another old movie and we're going to let the audience kind of help us decide what we're going to do next. So here's the five we're going to throw out there. We're going to put this on a poll. So you guys let us know, go to our Twitter at Running Scared PD. And we're going to have a poll with these five movies: Halloween, the original; Friday the 13th, the original, right? We're not doing any of these remakes. We're talking about
we're gonna go original with this one.
Nightmare on Elm Street, number one. Candyman, and they've got a new Candyman coming out. I've already seen posters for that.
Yep.
And Child's Play. So one of those five. Let us know which one you want us to do. You were saying we've been doing the same rating because we've been picking movies we like. So maybe it'll be fun to get a movie that one of us hates or one of us doesn't like as much, and we have a little more cutting it down.
And these
disagreement.
For sure. And these are like subgenre slasher ones. You know, we've seen them many times. So it'll be good to go back and rewatch one of them, have a pod on it, and you let us know which one we should do. I'd love to do all of them. Which one do you want to hear? Again, at Running Scared PD for Twitter, at Running Scared Pod on Instagram, or you can send us your selection at therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Rob, thank you. This has been a great episode. How is, just before we leave, how's the packing going for the new house?
Barely started, buddy. We dropped off some things, but it's going slow.
All right, good stuff. All right, listen, it's been great. So I'll see you next time on Running Scared.
The Running Scared podcast is produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, edited by Robert Lendrum, with help from my buddy Nick Andrade over at Autosave. Original music by Jamie Roberts. See you next time on Running Scared.
In the most terrible agony, knowing for certain your soul will leave your body and you will no longer be a person. And that, this is certain. The worst thing is that it is certain.